Okay. So, yesterday when you called, she set your fucking ass up. She had a news reporter there and had you on speakerphone, dude. And the news reporter heard you telling her you're the best. They've got it all over the TV, okay? I'm getting ready to play it for you. My wife's sitting
here.
You're kidding me, dude. And she's got the story where Mila calls you a fucking monster, where she says you're a psychopath and she's your ex and you were going to kill her. And they recorded.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Right, let's get on with today's true crime case, which is one of those that is just breathtakingly terrible. So let's talk about Wade Wilson. A lot of you might have seen Wade Wilson because he's been all over court TV. There's been a lot of people reporting about it online. And one of the things that's quite notable about him is the face tattoos. And so I think that the picture is so unusual that a lot of people in the mainstream are just connecting with his face in this way because it is atypical to what we see on a day-to-day basis. So even if you haven't heard the story, you might well have seen who this character is. So Wade Wilson was born on the 20th of May, 1994. He's from Fort Myers in Florida. And I would say his life got off to a challenging start to some degree. His biological parents were teenagers when he was born. And that is not to say for one moment that you cannot be an A-grade parent when you are a teenager. You can. But we have to be honest that economically and support-wise, it can be a lot more challenging for people who are younger. Also, I want to make it clear that teenagers who get pregnant and carry on with the pregnancy, when there are other options, are incredibly brave. And that's notable and testament to those individuals making a choice where a child is given life, even if not to stay with them as parents. And that's exactly what happens. He's born, but he's then put up for adoption. And he was adopted by a couple called Steve and Candace Wilson. He was very much wanted by them and clearly was somebody who was going to make their family an even more beautiful place to reside. He attended Deer Lake Middle School and Lawton Childs High School, and he graduated in 2013. His early life was certainly marked by those challenges, I would say. So his biological mother is said to have had mental health issues. She was also somebody who apparently struggled with addiction. And this in itself can be problematic because we all appreciate that whilst you are gestating in the womb, everything that your parent does to you during that period of time can have an impact on who you are growing up because of the impact that it can create and cause on the fetus during development. And we know, for example, people who drink very heavily, children can be born with alcohol fetal syndrome, but any narcotics that go into the system can certainly have an impact on the brain. So it's not ideal if you have a parent who is taking drugs or drinking during the pregnancy. Not all babies are born with organic damage. It is notable what's happening to him during gestation. Now, as I said, Wilson is actually adopted, and the reason that that happens is because the parents of Wade Wilson's biological mother actually attended the church with Steve and Candace Wilson. So essentially they know the family and know that Candace and Steve have two daughters of their own who are very well loved. So it's a perfect scenario, really. They're a God-fearing folk. It's a scenario where clearly they feel that they can send this child who may have had a difficult start to a family who are loving and connected and give Wade Wilson a new opportunity to thrive. And this is some time after his birth. It's not a late adoption. So he has the opportunity to form secure attachment. And we all know that secure attachment is powerful. Children who are securely attached genuinely don't have the same level of mental health issues, don't have the same issues around self-esteem. Because when you have a secure attachment and you feel that you are always safe and you feel that people are rooting for you and you feel that you've got a foundation of security, understandably, it makes life just that little bit easier. And so when we look at activation factors and triggers regarding how we end up with our mental health and the issues surrounding that, clearly, the more secure your attachment, the better the outcomes for you. And that is told time and time and time again in research. Now, according to Wade Wilson's adoptive family, initially, he was well-adjusted. He was a very sporty child. He was an active child, and he really did fit in with the family members, he was connected to them. There was nothing notable in those early years that caused them to question who he was mentally, physically, and also how he felt. Because to all intents and purposes, before 11, things were fine. But around the age of 13, and I think that anybody who has ever had a 13-year-old child, but let's be honest, guys, we've all been 13. Literally, my mum said that neighbours said they could hear me screaming up the road. Now, I don't know whether mum was just saying that, because she really didn't like me shouting at times, but I imagine she was probably correct. They probably could hear me screaming down the road. And I am a very peaceful person. I've never even raised my voice at my own children. And that isn't something I'm saying on a joke level. I mean it. My kids and me communicate in a really peaceful way. So I can see me at 13 and me now are dramatically different. And that's because there are so many changes that take place. And we're not just talking on a physical level because your body's changing. We're talking about a neurobiological level, physiological experience level. We're talking about social level. We're talking about educational level. There are a whole heap of things that just add to the chaos of development. So it is interesting that at 13 years of age, people who know him, and this is including his classmates, who say, certainly from their point of view, there was a spiral in his behavior around 13 years of age. That has to be explored on all of those levels that I've just discussed, because for his family to see this very notable change, it says that something is going on in his psychology, but also potentially in his physiology. Now, he's attending Deer Lake Middle School, and then he goes on to Lawton Charles High School. And those classmates said that there were some troubled years during that period of time. His family start to notice that he's becoming quite withdrawn, that he's becoming quite paranoid. And I don't think it's that unusual for teenagers to withdraw around the age of 13, 14 years of age. In fact, there are lots of people who work in my trade in the therapeutic field who will talk about, particularly with parents of boys, oh, well, they might disappear between the ages of about 13 and 19. Now, we don't mean disappear as in like a magic act. I am gone, now I'm back at 19. We mean that sometimes young men in particular, they go within themselves. It doesn't matter what wonder you have in your family, how connected you are, there is just almost a withdrawing into the self and a getting to know themselves before they kind of come like the butterfly from the chrysalis and become the person that they've grown into. So often we will see children and young people as they move into their teenage years, but most notably boys, just not quite as engaged in the family. And that's really challenging because you're looking at that situation as a parent, you're thinking to yourself, is this to do with my child just going through the typical experiences of being a teenager, or is it indeed something deeper? Now, unfortunately, when it comes down to Wade Wilson, it's clearly on a much deeper level. He does get withdrawn, he does get paranoid, but he starts getting involved heavily in drug use. Now, anybody who's ever tried drugs, you will probably at some point during that experience have recognized that it can invoke a sense of paranoia. Cannabis can make you highly paranoid, highly suspicious. In fact, when we were growing up, we used to call it the fear. You'd get stoned and then you'd be like, oh, everybody's looking at me weird, or somebody's gonna come and knock on my door and wanna search my home. It's something that you can't help because that's one of the ways that the drug aggresses your nature, so to speak. But then add to that even more strong narcotics. If you have a predisposition for mental health issues, mental illness, it can be something that exacerbates these hugely. That's a lot of the research looking at schizoaffective disorder and schizophrenia, particularly if you're a teenage boy and you're smoking high levels of cannabis as a teenager, then the incidence of becoming a schizophrenic is far higher in that group. So certainly it is a trigger. And it seems that Wade Wilson's paranoia started to really manifest in incidents at home that were deeply problematic and noticed by the family. So he genuinely thought that people were watching him, that people were watching his family, and he actually started to say that he wanted the blinds to be shut because he was fearful of the outside world looking in. And this is absolutely in line with people who are starting to go on a mental health decline, that paranoia is often indicative of things like psychosis. So this is deeply problematic. On another occasion, he actually said that he was concerned that there was something in the garage. His father did what any good dad would do, and he actually went to try to allay those fears, looked around the garage, but there was nothing there. Then the police came and they found nothing unusual. And because his mental health is on such a decline, Wade ends up being subjected to the Baker Act. This is because his adoptive father had actually discovered drugs. And you can imagine, can't you? You're watching your child who you love deeply, who until he's hit puberty has been ideal in the family. There haven't been problems. And then all of a sudden you see that the drug use seems to be exacerbating this side of his nature that is going to be really problematic for him in the future, as well as in that moment. And so he's looking as a parent to do what's best for Wade Wilson. So he ends up taking him to receive some help in an inpatient facility. So the Baker Act basically is something where you can be taken for involuntary examination. So you don't have to consent to it, to a facility who is then going to be able to look at what's going on for you. And basically the Baker Act is about whether there's a reason to believe that the person has a mental illness, and due to the mental illness, that person's refusing or isn't actually able to determine if they need an examination or they need help. Because one of the things that's very notable, certainly from my own point of view, having a father who killed himself through psychosis, but also sadly suffered from psychosis, they don't think there's anything wrong with them. They think that they've got the world absolutely correct and everybody else has got it wrong. And it is as real to them as what I am saying now is real to you. So trying to say to that person, you need help, you need to take this medication, and that isn't computing because they are paranoid and they believe that potentially you are going to do something to harm them. So this is why the Baker Act exists. And also another note of that is that the Baker Act says that if the care or treatment isn't given, that person could essentially harm themselves or indeed could harm others. In the UK, we talk about it as sectioning, and you can do voluntary sectioning or involuntary sectioning. So the idea is that sometimes a person, even when they don't believe they need help, absolutely needs help. And if they don't receive that help, they could be a big problem to themselves or others. Now, he was briefly institutionalized, but he was released the following day. So ultimately, they must have assessed him and thought that he wasn't too seriously at risk to himself or others. And people will say, well, that's a very short amount of time. Is there a failure there? And indeed it could be. But particularly when somebody is suffering from delusions like psychosis, being in your familiar environment is really powerfully important. And the reason for that is you're already dealing with a sense of the world slipping away. And if you're in an unfamiliar environment, that slipping away can feel treacherous. So getting somebody home to be in the care of people who love them and care for them in an environment that feels like they understand and know what it is, that can be helpful in the healing. So that could well be why he was let go of from that actual institution. Now, despite those challenges, which are clearly big, Wade did actually do okay in school. He actually got decent grades throughout his school. He got A's and B's and C's. So he was obviously somebody who had intellect and he was involved in sports. But one of the things that has happened during those sport experiences is apparently he sustained quite a lot of head injuries, and some of those head injuries led to concussions. Now, I'm sure that a lot of you will be aware of wrestlers and people who are involved in big sports that involve head-on collisions, such as American football. We know that there is a correlation between individuals who've had those injuries and violence. So we are actually aware of individuals who've succeeded unbelievably in their field in places such as boxing or, as I said, American football, who've gone on to do horrific things to their partners. Now, part of that is choice, of course, but we also have to look at the physiological damage and see that brain injury can have an impact. Not saying that's the case here. I'm just acknowledging that concussions are deeply problematic. My son's a Thai boxer. I hate it. I think it's great to keep fit too. But when he's in the ring and somebody's elbowing him in the head, it is not something that I enjoy, because your brain is really important and any injury to it can have far-reaching impact. Now, Wade's teenage years seem to go on that spiral. He's suspended from school for selling drugs, and by the age of 18, he's actually sustained more head injuries, apparently had two car accidents. One of them involved a head-on collision crashing into a tree. And at least one of those accidents resulted in a concussion. So that's a really high level impact. It takes a hell of a lot to get knocked out. I'm sure loads of you have experienced a serious knock on the head and you haven't actually blacked out. So he's had a numerous amount of concussions that are causing these blackout injuries. Now, despite undergoing several CT scans due to these various injuries, there was no actual fractures or bleeding found, but MRI scans, and those are the scans that provide really detailed brain imaging, they were actually never performed. So it could have been that there were more nuanced injuries that were not picked up when those accidents occurred. So it's notable to acknowledge that these consistent injuries of the head could also be exacerbating problems within his behaviour. Now, as Wade enters adulthood, this is when he has his own choices, isn't it? I mean, we've already seen that in his adolescent, he's making bad choices and he's got a spiralling of his mental health. But of course, when you get over 18, well, your parents can tell you what to do. They can demand that you do things. But you're an adult. You can go out and do what you choose to do. And this is when I would say his life really is chaotic. He's in and out of prison. And he's come from a really good family, bear that in mind, a really nice family. So this is going to be territory that they have never imagined was ever going to play out in their future. They adopted a little boy. They thought they could give him a great home. They thought he'd thrive. And now they're dealing with a child who is an adult who's now incarcerated regularly. So beginning in 2010, he actually accumulated over 20 charges. These included assault and fraud. So it's a spectrum. When you think about individuals who have poor impulse control, well, we see violence play out regularly in those situations because they're not thinking, they're just acting. But with somebody like Wilson, we're talking about assault, so violence on one level, and fraud, which is conning people, defrauding people on another. So he's across the spectrum of criminality. And according to prison records, he was actually incarcerated in the Florida Department of Corrections on burglary and grand theft convictions from November the 26th, 2013 to September the 19th, 2014. And he served a second prison sentence for firearms theft. And that was from October the 17th, 2017 to July the 15th, 2018. So this guy's got a lot of form. That's what I'm saying. There is a consistent offending pattern. And like I said, it's a spectrum of offending, which is vast. In 2015, Wilson was actually charged with sexual battery and kidnapping in Tallahassee, but he was acquitted later at trial. Obviously, he was acquitted. That does not mean he was not guilty. And to be fair, when we're talking about somebody like Wilson, I'd be really surprised if he wasn't guilty of whatever he was accused of, because we're talking about a double homicide in this case, and a double homicide of completely innocent individuals who could not have in any way, shape or form imagined the monster that they were with at the time that they were killed. Now, in 2018, he also emerged as a figure but wasn't actually charged in the Tallahassee murder conspiracy case of Denise Williams. That was in the death of her husband, Mike Williams. So he is on the fringe or directly at the centre of deeply problematic behaviour and outcomes at the criminal level. We get to February 2019. At this point, a woman reported to the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office that Wilson, who was her ex-boyfriend, had beaten her and strangled her. And according at this point to reports, the authorities did not actually find probable cause to arrest Wilson. But again, I think we're all on the same page here, aren't we? It seems to be reasonable to imagine that whatever she was saying he did, he 100% did. Now, Wade's biological father, bear in mind he's been absent from his life, he talked in court about the fact that Wade actually reconnected with him when he turned 18 years of age. He said that primarily the reason that Wade was getting in contact with him was because he wanted money. I would also imagine that Wade wants to know who he is, where he's come from, also wants to understand why he didn't continue down the path of being looked after by his biological parents. I think that children who adopted absolutely have a right to ask those questions and absolutely need answers on the whole. I think that it's really powerful for him in that moment to connect with an individual that he's blood related so that he can just form an understanding of where he came from at the very least. But it can also mean that he's trying to change history. So he recognises that he doesn't relate fully to the people who've loved and brought him up. maybe their characteristics and morals are not in the same place and space as his are. So talking to his biological father, maybe he's seeking to see, why am I the way that I am? I can't say that as fact, but on a psychological level and working in therapy for so many years, I would imagine that's part of why he's seeking. Apparently he had sporadic communication with his biological father, Stephen Testecker. This is obviously from the age of 18. So he's in and out of Stephen's life, essentially. And it makes sense as well that as a biological parent, when your child has come back into your life, even if that child is coming back because they want money off you, there's going to be a level of guilt for the fact that you rejected them, at least in their minds, and therefore you may want to do your best to make them feel that there is an open door to you. But equally, that can be problematic. But it also means that that child has another opportunity to find a way of seeking out things like money for drugs, because that person is feeling guilty about what happened in the past. And that means that Wade Wilson isn't going to get the help that he needs, because he's not on the floor, because people are meeting his needs in those moments of trouble and chaos when he's run out of cash, in this case, going to his biological father, Stephen. Now, it's clear at this point that we're dealing with a repeat offender, and it's clear at this point we're dealing with a danger to women, that goes without saying. But wow, Wade Wilson's offending sinks to what only can be described as a whole new and utterly depraved level on October the 7th, 2019. And this is when Wade meets a woman called Christine Melton. She was 35 at the time. She's actually with a friend, Stephanie Sailors. They're at the Buddha Live at a Fort Myers bar. Now, Christine Melton, a lovely woman, 35 years of age, no age at all. She was raised in Illinois. She moved to Cape Coral with a friend, and she was working as a waitress. She was a godmother. And I always think that when we choose our godparents for our children, basically they're the people who, if anything happens to us, are meant to step in. So we have to have ultimate trust in them. We have to believe that they're the kind of person that would nurture our children if anything terrible happened to us. They'd bring them up in the way that we expect them to be brought up. So clearly she is somebody that shines in that way. She was a cat lover, just like I am. She was a great friend to people who adored her. She was described by her friends as really quick-witted, very kind. And one of the things that was very notable about her character was that as a human being, she was somebody that made people feel safe, that they felt understood when she was around them, when she was hearing them. Her favourite holiday was apparently Halloween. And her cousin actually said that one of the things that Christine dreamed of was to be a mum. And that's the role that has been denied her, because of what I'm going to tell you. So after the bar has closed, Wilson and those two women that he's met, they go to the home of a guy called Jason Shepherd. So this is where they stay for a number of hours. They're having a good time, and then they leave in the morning, and everything's been fine. But things are about to change, and they're going to change in the most horrific of ways. And just bear this in mind. Christine has met Wade Wilson. They've spent hours together. It's been absolutely fine. They've had fun. They've probably been drinking. There's probably been some intimacy. But at the end of the day, it's just one of those nights where you meet a stranger and that stranger becomes a friend. So with that in mind, that trio end up returning to Christine's home. This is in Cape Coral. Then Sailor leaves. So her friend leaves. Because why wouldn't she? At the end of the day, they've all been together. It's been fine. They've had fun. But this means that Wilson is now alone with Christine. And like I know, there is no way at this point that Christine could know that her life is in ultimate danger. While she's asleep, and they believe this happened when she was asleep, Wilson, out of the blue, strangles her to death in her own home. A home that she had invited Wade Wilson into. A home that she should have felt safe in. A home that should have been her sanctuary. But in the end, it's the place that marks her doom. And it's utterly blindsiding to imagine that this man can have been with her for all this time, all those hours, and there is nothing that struck her or her friend that he could have any of this malevolence within him. In fact, like I said, her friend has left and felt that everything was okay. So he's clearly given no vibes off that would make anybody question him or his motives. But he just murders her mercilessly. And then to add insult to injury, he just leaves and takes her car with him. Now, her body ends up getting found the next day. So he's had a period of time in between killing and her body being discovered. Now, that very same day that he has murdered Christine, Diane Ruiz is reported missing. Now, Diane Ruiz is one of those people that everyone said was just an absolutely lovely human being. She was engaged to be married. She was a mother to two sons. She had a 29-year-old boy called Brandon Cooler and a 19-year-old boy called Zane Romero. She was a bartender in Cape Coral. Apparently, she had this incredibly magnifying personality. She had a really loud laugh, and she was so looking forward to seeing her son make his debut in his school marching band in a few days. So she is living her best life. She's loving her family experience, and she is just walking to work. It's as simple as that. She's just going about her business. Her co-workers actually said that she never ever missed a shift for over 5 years of working at the bar where she worked. In fact, they called her the heartbeat of the bar. And like I said, she's totally unrelated to Wilson. There is no connection between them whatsoever. But a short time after he has literally choked the life out of Christine, he sees 43-year-old Diane just walking along a Cape Coral street. He asks her for directions to a nearby school. And then we don't know exactly what happened, whether he lured her into the car that he was driving or whether he forced her under threat into the car. But basically, she ends up in that vehicle, the vehicle that he'd stolen from Christine's home. After she's in there, he strangles her to death. It's unbelievable because as I say the words, I hear the senselessness of that killing. There is no build-up. There is no connection. There is nothing this woman has done. It's just as if he's killed and now he wants to kill again. Then, after realizing that Diane is actually still alive, so he thinks he's killed her, but she's still breathing, he then pushes her from the car and then he runs over her body up to 20 times until she's dead. Diane's body was actually found 3 days later in a field behind Sam's club. She had to be identified by the tattoo on her back because there was an advanced state of decomposition, which again means her family will not have been able to say goodbye. When people murder in this way, they're not just stealing the final goodbye because of the killing, they're stealing the final goodbye because the family members won't be able to actually see that person again. They won't be able to hug their body one last time and say goodbye because it's in such a state. And there's actually really unsettling security footage that's captured shortly after Wilson brutally murdered both of the women. And this is him driving wildly into a parking lot. So that indicates that high level of adrenaline. So he's obviously in a really agitated, high energy state at that moment in time. Wilson actually parks his car, gets out, and then walks into one of the shops and disappears from the view of the camera. But the fact that he can even go into a shop after carrying out such a brutal slaying of two women speaks of a man who can compartmentalise his evil. Now, following those murders, this is on the 7th of October, Wilson then drove to Fort Myers in Christine's car, and then he attacks his ex-girlfriend, a woman called Melissa Montanez. Now, the very fact that he's brutally killed two women and he's not satisfied, he's now gone to his girlfriend's house, albeit an ex-girlfriend, and he's now attacked her. So after this attack, Melissa Montanez calls the police and lets them know that Wade Wilson had attacked her. So it seems that from this moment, Wilson goes to Joe's Crab Shack. That's at 224 West 1st Street. That's in Fort Myers. And the police actually found Wilson in Melissa's car because he's dumped Christine's car and stolen Melissa's car from when he's attacked her. And at this point, he's basically outside the restaurant and he's not wearing a shirt. So it could be hot weather, but again, it speaks to an agitated state. It speaks to somebody who's potentially dealing with a range of mental health issues in that moment. Now, when the officer goes up to Wade Wilson, he basically tells her that he's been waiting for her, but then he asks why he's being stopped. And eventually the officer says, "You're being stopped because of the battery this morning." Now, Wilson immediately denies it is attack, Melissa. The officer then says to him, "Can you just turn the car off, hand over your keys?" Because they want to get some backup. Bear in mind, this guy is likely dangerous. But Wilson ignores them, restarts the car, just drives away. And the officer's actually shouting after him, "Don't go anywhere, don't do it," because clearly you are upping your charges when you're fleeing a potential stop in this way by the officers. Now, after he's fleed police, Wilson then drives to Matteo Graphics, 2309 Hancock Bridge. So he then walks in shirtless, he's covered in blood, and he basically goes and seeks help from a guy called Josh Lukic. He's the business owner, but he's also an acquaintance of Wilson. Wilson then says that he needs to leave town, and the reason that he needs to leave town is because he has killed someone. Lukic, doing the right thing, immediately calls 911. So it's clear to this guy that Wade Wilson isn't lying. There is something about what he said, there is the way that he's conveyed it, the fact that he's covered in blood, that makes him take it absolutely seriously. Now, after this, Wilson leaves, breaks into and burgles the home of Kent and Fanny Amlin. They'd actually left the home for the day to go to Ohio, which is a good thing because God knows what would have happened to them otherwise. So he goes essentially on the run. It's for a very short period of time, but he's intending and trying and putting in place the variables required for him to escape. Now, Wilson actually gets arrested on the 8th of October. At this point, he's remanded in custody and he's not given bail because essentially they know they are dealing with a very violent person. Apparently, when he's arrested, his biggest concern was to get a hamburger and fries. It's one of those things that I imagine you might have a craving for. We've all had them, haven't we? You know? You're walking around, you're thinking, "Oh, I could really do with a dirty burger." But I'm just going to throw it out there that probably, if I've just been arrested, quite serious charges, and I'm thinking about what do I want? Probably want a lawyer. Probably want to be able to speak to somebody who might be able to help me with this precarious situation. I'm not sure that I've gone for the burger and fries option in that moment, but apparently he didn't get the memo on the right kind of representation. But that's essentially what he wanted. He wanted to get a hamburger and fries. And if he went ahead and got those, that would mean that he'd speak to the authorities at Lee County Jail. In November, it's at this point he's indicted on multiple charges, which included the counts of first degree murder. And in 2019, he ends up speaking to news outlets from jail. And bear in mind, you will hear some of the phone calls that he makes to people that he knows from jail, and he's very excited about the opportunity to speak to news outlets. Clearly, he has a lot to say, even though that's BS. The point is, he isn't somebody who is shy and retiring at that point regarding the belief that he's got things that the world need to know. And he actually says that he didn't commit the murders. He says he's innocent. Aren't they all? I mean, aren't they all innocent, all these people who are in prison for really serious murders, usually with some additional value of things like CCTV that shows that they're the only person possible of murdering individuals. But still, we're all innocent. Prison is apparently full of innocent individuals. He also said that he used to be connected to a high-level human trafficking ring and that he basically groomed women for them. He then said that he wanted to leave the ring the year before he's been caught, and the group framed him for these murders as punishment. So now he's just a victim. Now he is just a victim of circumstance. He is not the murderer. He is not a terrible human being for acting in the most malevolent way possible. No, he is merely an individual who has been framed for this situation. I mean, it's an elaborate framing, isn't it? It's a lot of elaborate parts to that framing. I mean, literally, he met one of his victims at a bar with her friend, and that friend can evidence exactly what happened. And the other woman was just some innocent person walking to work. So a bit of elaborate framing there, a little bit of pushing boundaries regarding believability, just throwing it out there. Now, whilst Wilson is awaiting trial, let's just say the offending nature within him doesn't dissipate. He doesn't go up. He's not like, "Do you know what? I've been arrested. It's probably time to toe the line. particularly because I've got a court case of very serious charges levied against me coming up. And I think probably I should just go about my business, maybe try and get a little job. Just be nice to people. Just do things that are nice that indicate that my character is not sullied. And that therefore, when I appear in court, they're not going to be able to add questionable actions of mine onto and into the case itself. Well, he didn't get that memo either, because whilst he is awaiting trial, him and his cellmate, a guy called Joseph Katz, literally try to escape. So they try to escape in October 2020 from the Lee County Court facility. It is reported that they'd actually managed to break their window in the cell. This is how they were going to attempt to escape, but they were caught by the authorities in time. Don't get me wrong, I don't imagine that even if they got through the window, they'd have been able to escape. But the point is, they were trying. So even when they're awaiting trial for these situations to play out and be dealt with appropriately, Wade Wilson does not want to be in that courtroom. He's got other ideas for a life outside of being incarcerated. Now, those actions actually led to the new charge of attempted escape and criminal mischief, and that was added to Wilson's criminal record. Also, you'll note in the press, if you look this case up, he's actually been dubbed the Deadpool Killer. And the reason for that is he shares a name with the Marvel character. But let's be clear, he ain't no hero. And I know that Deadpool is not necessarily your classic hero. No disrespect to you, Ryan Reynolds. But at the end of the day, he's still a hero. He's still somebody that we know whatever he does in between is going to come out on the positive side. Unlike the Wade Wilson we're talking about today. The fact that whilst he's incarcerated, he's been charged for these crimes demonstrates that, again, he just isn't able to contain that offending behaviour. And it's not just that that he's arrested for. So in April 2023, he's arrested on drug charges. Now, bear in mind, in prison, they're not going to have drugs, but we all know that in the UK and America and the Western world, full stop, definitely drugs get in. We know that there are shady officers who literally bring drugs in for those who are in prison. We know that there's a whole racket going on. And also, he's got dependency issues on the outside, so that probably isn't going to change in a stressful situation in prison. So I totally appreciate that if he can get access to drugs, he's going to take the opportunity to get access. But in April 2023, basically a canine doing checks outside their door find that there are drugs within the actual cell that he's staying in. That dog finds two bags, both of them tested positive for methamphetamine. They also contained loose cigarettes, suspected narcotics, lighters and pills. And according to court documents, a trustee, and a trustee is basically an inmate who gets special privileges for being trustworthy. Bit ironic, because in this case, that trustee is dealing drugs. He'd apparently given drugs to Wilson and to another inmate, and officials reviewed recorded inmate phone calls and actually learned that Wilson spoke to someone named Bonnie Wiggins about narcotics. They then did this undercover investigation. They watched Wiggins and three more suspects outside of jail, and this resulted in six people being arrested, including Wilson, on drug-related charges. So like I said, there was an industry there. There was your trustee who was a bad'un. There were people on the outside who were involved with getting drugs in. And essentially, Wilson was receiving what he needed on the inside through that manner. So, like I said, this is not somebody who is towing the line in any way, shape or form. Arguably, one can say, well, he's dead to rights. He's banged to rights. We all know that. He's not going to ever be getting out of prison. So he's probably thinking, hey, heap as many charges on me. I don't care. I may as well at least escape reality by taking these drugs, because I'm not going to be walking anywhere as a free man. Now, one of the striking things I've found about this case is the phone calls that have been put out there. Wade Wilson calling his ex-girlfriend. They are really bizarre to listen to. Bear in mind that you can see that his ex is distressed. The fact that he's done these horrible things. He's murdered two women in cold blood out of nowhere. And he, during those phone calls, is trying to sound sad. But sometimes it sounds almost like he's laughing, even though he's trying to act like he's crying. It just feels off to me when I listen. And I often think about people who are psychopathic, sociopathic, and the fact that when they are dealing with somebody in a high-level emotional state, they will often try to mimic. It's a way of wearing another person's emotions to seem like you connect. But because it's not authentic, it just feels tangibly off. And that's exactly how it is when you listen to those phone calls. He just doesn't come across as authentic. And even in the early phone calls, he's basically suggesting that he's potentially going to get off. Maybe there's a way forward. Maybe he can get out. And the excitement that he shows about potential sit-down interviews with the press. So suddenly being seen, suddenly being notable. And again, that speaks of somebody whose mindset just doesn't connect with the gravity and depravity of his actions. For most people, if you're in prison, you're charged with two homicides of innocent women. The last thing you're going to be is excited about talking to the press, because the press are there to execute you. And not just in written form, in video form, probably in actual form as you are sent to your death, being put to death by the state. That's what the press are going to do when such a gravity of a crime has occurred. But he's excited.
I'm not a monster. Yeah, I'm not a saint either by any means. I've made bad decisions in the past, of course, things that we were doing from Key West to Fort Myers, including the human trafficking, including, you know, various other things, prostitution with the women, drug trafficking.
And when you think about people who have psychopathy, often one of the things that trips them up is that narcissistic tendency that they have, where they like being the center of attention. They like being seen as something notable, even if that notable is the most depraved notable that any of us can even think up. Also, during his time in prison, he started to add a number of tattoos to his face and neck. So the Wilson that you see prior to him going into prison is a very different character to who you see after he's been in prison for a period of time. So he's got face tattoos, neck tattoos, including several swastikas. He's got that menacing Joker-like mouth tattoo, and he's got a neck tattoo that reads "Bread for War." So you can clearly note that he's obviously engaging with people on the inside that he feels he relates to, both on the level of views, but also potentially for protection. And he's engaging in those, what I would consider are gang look tattoos, to feel that he belongs somewhere. So he's creating a persona. He's stepping in to his new outfit, so to speak, in prison. Now, understandably, those tattoos, when it comes down to being in court, I don't know, are a bit of a problem. Because I'm just going to say, if I'm on a jury and I'm, you know, looking for, I don't know, subtle nuances to suggest whether this person is potentially guilty or innocent, you know, or if I'm on the fence about things, I'm going to be looking at the things that can direct me in a direction that makes me believe that whatever I come to the conclusion over is based on me making the right decision, right? And if you're on the fence and you're looking at somebody and you're like, you know, well, he looks like a nice man, presenting himself well, wearing a nice suit, clean shaven, you know, it shouldn't matter, but we know it does matter. But if I'm looking and I'm like, do you know what? Have you noticed anything about Wilson? Well, I mean, I don't like his hairstyle. No, aside from just the general fashion statements, anything else? Not really. Have you not noticed the swastikas? Are they worrying you? Oh, come to think about it, yeah, swastikas. Because I'm just thinking, it's very Nazi-like, isn't it? I'm thinking Third Reich. I'm thinking about, you know, the rise of the Führerprinzip and the idea of the all-powerful Hitler and the murder and execution of over 12 million people. That's what it's resonating with me. The fact that he's actively, during the period of being in prison, gone ahead and had those put on him. And I'm feeling like that says maybe he's a really bad person. Yeah, I just think his hairstyle's terrible. I'm not saying that we can't include that. I'm just going for the swastikas right now. And that doesn't even include the bit around his mouth. But anyway, bread for war. Not good if you've got a jury making a decision about your future. And his attorney understandably actually asked if Wilson could conceal his tattoos with makeup throughout the trial, because he basically would potentially be seen as a bad light if he walked into court looking that way. They said Wilson has numerous and varied tattoos on his face, including stitches, swastikas, and other tattoos that might be objectionable to members of the potential jury pool. Now, the motion requested as well, he would like to appear presentable to the jury deciding his guilt or innocence, or whether he lives and dies. Now, bear in mind, that's absolutely something we would expect. The judge did actually very graciously grant the motion, but Wilson then refused to actually cover his tattoos during the trial. He did wear street clothes during the trial, which is something he'd asked for as well. But like I said, that does not come across as a good look. It really doesn't. But again, think about the psychology of this man. He probably knows he's never going anywhere freely. So is it more important to seem cool and totally down with your prison mates? Or is it good to seem like you're trying to be a good little citizen when it's going to probably lead you nowhere? He's probably gone for the more obvious choice of, I want to seem remorseless. I want to seem somebody who you should be afraid of, because he's got to go back and deal with the prison system. Now, his trial, it actually commenced on the 10th of June, 2024. That was heard in Cape Coral. Bear in mind, there's been a 5-year delay. Now, this was due to a number of things. So the first one was Wilson's first attorney died. Don't think he had anything to do with it, although I would imagine that a case like this would lay heavy on your mind. But he did, of course, then attempt to escape, which is problematic. It's going to extend the issues regarding your case because it adds extra charges. And also then we had the horrendous pandemic, so that put everything back. Now, during the trial, the prosecutors were just straight down the line. They look at this man as a cold-blooded executioner. End of. They said that Wilson killed both of those women literally for the sake of killing. They also said that the murders were premeditated. And the reason that they said that is, they said premeditation starts by placing the hands on the throat of another. This is who Gardner, who was leading the prosecution, said. They then added that the killings of Christine and Diane were clearly first degree premeditated murder. Now, throughout the trial, what I would say is Wilson's defense were always going to have a really difficult job. We're talking about the slaying of two women. We're talking about it being a completely unprovoked attack. One potentially being asleep, the other being ran over repeatedly after being throttled. There is not a lot of places for Wilson's defense to go. But what they plump for is to say that, listen, Wilson was highly intoxicated by drugs that he'd taken the night before, and also the fact that they genuinely believe that Wade Wilson had what they called a diseased mind, and this in parallel with the disease of drug addiction. Their defense actually said, I'm not arguing insanity. I'm arguing the state is claiming premeditation. I'm arguing he's whacked out of his mind for any of this. That's what Attorney Lee Hollander reportedly told the court. So they're going for this idea that there's organic damage potentially to the brain, and that is exacerbated problematically by the use of drugs. And to some degree, even though he's gone ahead and carried out two horrific murders, he was not necessarily computing what he was doing in that moment. Now, I will be honest with you, I think the use of saying that drugs had played into him being whacked out of his mind, so he therefore goes and kills without really understanding what's going on, just doesn't make sense. The first one, you could kind of go down that road of just losing his mind momentarily, but we're talking about him then stealing a car, accosting another woman, throttling her, running over her 20 times potentially, and then driving and attacking an ex-girlfriend. It just does not compute that this is a moment of madness, because it's protracted and drawn out over a period of time. So what I'm saying from the get-go is the defense have a very, very hard target if they're trying to suggest that he doesn't have the culpability level of premeditation. Now, the prosecution, they say, listen, we get it. Wilson had used drugs, he had used alcohol, but at the end of the day, that argument that you're using, that drugs or alcohol could lead to this horrific set of actions, is just plain insulting. That's the words that they used. Now, in spite of the fact that this man has executed these two women in the most horrendous of ways, he still has people who care for him. And his adoptive parents actually submitted letters to the court saying that Wilson was a really joyful child who loved his parents, and said, listen, this is about him slipping and sliding after his drug addiction began. This is because he became delusional. And they feel that there were opportunities that were missed and help that should have been given that were failed to be given that resulted in what we're dealing with in my video today. That actually, in some ways, Wade Wilson was failed and if that failure hadn't have occurred, I would not be telling this story. Equally, when you love a child, you do it without condition on the whole. There are some people who can do tough love and see their children do horrible things and walk away. But most of us are indelibly connected to our children. We just feel this connection, whether they're adopted, fostered, or whether we birth them ourselves. The point is, they are ours. And you can't help but remember the good times. You can't help but see the best. And you can't help but look for reasons and answers that can answer the question of how can somebody I love have acted in such a deplorable way? How can this child that ran around the yard, that I took to games, that I watched in sports, that I celebrated successes with, how am I now in court looking at them potentially losing their life for taking the life of others? And that bias can make you search for answers that dismiss the responsibility of the individual. In this case, saying it's drugs or mental health. Look, I'm not saying that drugs and mental health don't play into him making the choices he made, but I'm saying you have to have a core within you. I would say a core of malevolence running through your veins for you to action what I'm talking about today. But I understand wholeheartedly that his adoptive parents feel this sense of loyalty to him. Now, when the actual case began, it was huge. The state called 29 witnesses to testify. One of those witnesses was Wilson's biological father. He took the stand. Bear in mind, as I've said, Wilson had connected with his biological father, Stephen Tetesecca, later in life when he was over 18. But what Stephen said was they were never actually close. Now, after Wade Wilson had carried out the murders, he called his father, Stephen, several times. This is on October the 7th. And he actually said to his father, "I'm a killer." And at that point, Stephen just didn't compute that it could be real. He just thought he was telling him a story. In court, he actually said he's a good storyteller. Now, we can take from that he means he's a good liar. But down the line that same day, in another phone call, it just dawned on him, my God, this man's telling me the truth. He has killed. At this point, Stephen said that Wilson went into really gory details about the murders of the two women. And he said that he admitted strangling his first victim, Christine, when she was sleeping. He then said he rolled her up in a carpet. And then he said that he told him that he'd picked up a woman, which is obviously Diane, asked her for directions, choked her, and then ran over her several times. In fact, up to 20 times, they believe. He said that Wilson told him that Diane was alive when he ran over her. And he said that he wanted to make her look like spaghetti. It is incomprehensible to even speak those words and not then take a breath and a pause to think about what that means. That this man had taken Diane, this much-loved mother, and not just throttled her and taken the air from her lungs and believed that he killed her successfully that way, but when he realised that he hadn't, to repeatedly run over and reverse over her until, as he put it, she looked like spaghetti, to decimate her body and to want to do that, it is just unbelievable to me. Now, during one of those phone calls that Wilson makes to Stephen, his father, Stephen offers to send him an Uber, which is very clever. So he's basically saying, look, wherever you are, you let me know. I'll get an Uber to come and pick you up and bring you here. The minute that Wilson believes his biological father and thinks an Uber's going to be sent for him, gives him instructions as to where he is, and of course, Stephen immediately tells law enforcement the address of where he is. So, thank God, Stephen actually had the good grace to not protect a man who was clearly in absolute danger to be on the streets. And one of the things that Stephen really struggled with is that Wilson was really excited to talk to him about the murders. He said he was wanting me to feel the same way he was feeling. He would have done it again. Chilling. That was the takeaway that his biological father had, that this man was excited. He was glad that he'd done it and that he'd have done it again. Now, the prosecutors during the case actually referenced a jailhouse interview, and this is the jailhouse interview where Wilson admitted to the murders. He said, I choked her out until she couldn't breathe anymore. I came across my mind to murder, just kill, kill, kill. And Wilson allegedly told detectives I would do it again. Now, bear in mind, the defence, they've got all this going on. It's not looking good, is it? At the end of the day, there's a very powerful prosecution case. The state aren't struggling for witnesses, including a biological father of this man. So they need to really think about how they're going to get the jury to see Wilson in a very different way. I mean, he's presenting as somebody covered in tattoos with swastikas. He's presenting in a way that doesn't make the jury feel that he's a safe person to be out. We've got the additional issues of him trying to escape from prison, the drugs and narcotics charges. So it's bad for Wilson, whichever way you look at it. So they need to try to create a more sympathetic approach to this killer. They try to paint this picture of a very damaged young man. So they call in a neuropsychologist, Dr. Hyman Eisenstein. Now, Dr. Hyman Eisenstein provided testimony, and that testimony basically said that Wilson had been diagnosed with depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, schizoaffective disorder, and a host of other mental health conditions. Eisenstein also noted that Wilson had a neurocognitive impairment, which means that his brain basically doesn't function like that of a normal, typical, healthy person. But the state's rebuttal to this used forensic psychologist Dr. Michael Herkov, who argued that there actually wasn't sufficient evidence to support a diagnosis of a psychotic disorder. Instead, Herkov suggested that Wilson's extensive history of drug abuse, both documented and self-reported, was a more plausible explanation for the killer's delusions and recurrent criminal behaviour. Now, we all know how it goes. You get an expert for the defence who says, "My client is somebody who's suffered from A, B, and C," and the prosecution come in and go, "Nah, that's all rubbish. This is how it works in court." I would say it is not wrong to imagine that there were some issues that were developing in adolescence that clearly have amplified as he's become more problematic with drugs. I would imagine from what the family have reported, from what his friends have reported about the change in behaviour when he was 13, and certainly from his actions, that there probably is mental health issues that lie beneath what's going on for him. But that's not why he's acted in this way. My goodness, the idea that mental health is going to lead you to execute two women in this manner is just ludicrous. But this is the argument that's being brought in by the defense. Now, the prosecutors in their closing argument said this. They said this case was about killing for the sake of killing. Strangulation is the epitome of life slipping through someone's hands. This is a man with no respect for women and no respect for human life. Very powerful statement to make. On the 12th of June, the jury reached a verdict. It took 2 hours, and Wade Wilson was convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder. Wilson was also found guilty of grand theft, burglary of a dwelling, battery, and petty theft. Now, throughout the trial, one of the things that was, I would say, problematic for Wilson full stop and for people who viewed what he was like, he had a very smug and smirking demeanour. And I think that one of the reasons that this trial went viral is because it does not sit easy with us at all. That is not what we want to see. A defendant needs to look like they understand what they've done, the pain they've caused, the devastation they've created. And when somebody's looking smug or finding it funny, it goes against everything good human beings connect with, because we're looking at the face of malevolence and evil. Now, Wilson's sentencing was originally scheduled for July the 23rd, 2024, but the defense motioned for a delay over scheduling conflicts for expert mental health witnesses. So that motion was granted and the hearing was pushed back to August the 27th, 2024. Now, during his sentencing, the defense once again tried to point to Wilson's drug addiction. They were like, listen, he was out of his mind that night. His mental health was problematic. So they asked at this point for the judge to sentence him to 2 life sentences. They said, we'd ask the court to take into consideration that death is permanent. We all know that. It's coming for all of us, guys. But apparently that was the way the defense were going to go with it, that death is permanent. Just a biological reality, guys. Death is permanent. So we're just going to throw it out there. So is this you trying to plea for him to survive? Yeah, I'm pleading for him to survive because death is permanent. Do you know something we don't know? Because if it's permanent, it's permanent now and then. Yeah, I'm just saying words because I've got a really loose defense, guys. And I'm just saying, you know, You could kill him now, but that's permanent. Or you could kill him then, but that's permanent. Either way, guys, death is permanent. I'm not too sure that death's permanent. I'm pretty convinced death is just the beginning of a whole new journey. And we know where he's going in the elevator. Straight to the hot place that's smoking and ready for him. But that's the argument. Death is permanent. He beseeched the judge. And the judge is like, what? Sorry, what? Yeah, death is permanent. Sorry, what? Death is permanent? Why has nobody told me this before? One imagines the judge had figured that out at this point. He also, as a defence, called upon Dr. Mark Rubino. He's a neurologist. And that doctor said, listen, I found evidence of cognitive and emotional dysfunction, and this would have caused worsening behaviour. And also, it would have caused less critical thinking. He also said he found brain injury, which we all know can be deeply problematic in people's behaviour. So during this Zoom testimony, he said that recent brain scans that had been performed on Wilson indicated brain trauma, including impairment with short-term memory, along with cognitive and emotional problems in the setting of psychiatric disease. Now, in addition to the MRI, Rubino had actually run a series of tests to examine Wilson. He said that was difficult because Wilson was not very easy. He had to be restrained at the time. He also spoke to Wilson about his childhood. And Wilson apparently told that doctor that he was good up until the age of about 11. And then he just felt like he was absolutely going crazy. Wilson also told Rubino he was in two car accidents years ago, growing up in Tallahassee, one in which he was the passenger when the driver hit an oak tree and he hit his head on the windshield. And the second was when he and a group of friends were at the beach and again, he hit a tree. He said everybody got knocked out. And he said he started to run because he didn't want to be arrested because he was on probation. And then when he woke up, he ended up going back to EMS to get evaluated because he felt bad. So he'd left the scene of the accident, but then thought, oh, something's not right. But then he said he didn't actually go to the hospital for a follow-up because he didn't want to go to hospital. He also said that he had two concussions from football and baseball in high school. He also said that he got jumped three times and was knocked out each time. So a lot of head injuries. Now, Rubino said he was unable to obtain the medical records to support Wilson's claims, but he said that the stories about the head injuries were likely true based on the results of the scans. And the doctor actually stressed, I'm a neurologist, not a psychologist, but as a result of his head injuries, he would have had an issue with impulsiveness. He would likely have got overwhelmed by that emotion when he was in stressful situations or situations where he was under the influences. So he's talking about potentially frontal lobe damage that has added to Wilson's inability to control himself. But I mean, we can look at it each way. We can look at it, well, that's sad. That's really unfortunate. But we can also look at it, well, he's very dangerous and he should not be walking the streets under any circumstances because this is clearly somebody who cannot control themselves on any level. Now, bear in mind, in spite of that expert witness, the prosecution brought in one called Dr. Thomas Coyne, neuropathologist and associate medical examiner, who said they didn't find any damage to Wilson's skull or brain. Now, Wilson's lawyer, Kevin Shirley, ended up reading a letter out from Wilson's adoptive parents, which you will hear, and it is really sad. The only way that I can describe listening to that is with a pain in my heart, because we're talking about Wilson's adoptive parents being victims here too. I understand that it will compound their tragedy to lose him, but with respect, it's a choice he made. And whilst it would make their lives easier to not see somebody that they love put to death, when it comes down to it, these cases are not about the perpetrator. These cases are about protecting the integrity of justice and also speaking to the justice that's required for the victims' families.
Judge, this is a letter from the adoptive parents of Mr. Wilson. It's been 5 years since the worst of this began. You can't possibly understand how sorry we are for the families affected by this tragedy. We cannot change the past, but we wish we could. On that fateful day 5 years ago, not only were the lives and the dreams of two women lost, with their families left behind in shock and grief, but another family was left shocked and grieved over a different kind of loss. It's easy to recognize the victims and their families and to feel profound sympathy for all they suffered and lost. One group that isn't often recognized as those also suffering is the family of the accused. Our journey of loss didn't happen all in one day as theirs did, but it was heartbreaking nonetheless. Wade was a joyful child, loved his parents and sisters, and was loved immensely in return. But over the teen years, and then especially in the early years of adulthood, Wade began to slip away from us, becoming withdrawn, erratic, and depressed at first. Then, as addiction was added to mental illness, he became frankly paranoid and delusional, and the sense of loss became increasingly sharp. He was in the system for years trying to get help for his mental anguish and for his addiction. They put a tiny Band-Aid on it and then sent him back into the world without a diagnosis, medication, and without follow-up care. We tried to hold the pieces together, but had no idea how to find the support Wade needed to be the person he was inside. The system failed him, and that fateful day in 2019, we lost the last piece of the son we loved and all the hopes for his future. In those tragic moments, when the cancer of severe mental illness and addiction won, we lost our son, grandson, brother, nephew, and uncle. So we understand the despair, anguish, loss, and hatred for someone or something that takes away someone you love. Because despite everything, Wade is still our son, and we love him. The hopes and dreams of his life are already lost, but the human is still in there somewhere, tortured beyond what most of us can even begin to imagine. Taking his life will not bring back those two beautiful women. There is no justice on earth for that kind of loss. Taking another life only adds to the tragedy. Please see it in your heart not to kill our son and make our innocent family suffer even more. The system designed to help those who suffer and are lost failed him. That system is broken and would be only further broken if it took Wade's last breath. That broken system owes Christine, and it owes Diane, and it owes their families, and it owes our family. It owes us all the peace that it did not provide to Wade. Candy and Steve Wilson.
So it was a very emotional situation, but I would say the one person who wasn't showing any emotion was Wade Wilson, aside from the odd smirk here and there. So it was on the 27th of August, 2024, that Florida County Circuit Judge Nicholas R. Thompson ruled that Wade Wilson would be sentenced to death for the murders of Christine Melton and Diane Ruse. With Christine Melton, it was a 9-3 majority. With Diane Ruse, it was a 10-2 majority. And they don't need everyone to agree in that state for the death penalty to happen, just a majority. And in this case, it was overwhelming on both levels. He was also sentenced to an additional 21 years on battery, theft and burglary charges to be served concurrently. That judge said, given the facts of the case, nothing in the defendant's background or mental state would suggest that a death sentence is inappropriate. As he was sentenced to death, Wilson was actually caught flashing a mysterious hand signal as he sat stony-faced. The hand signal has sparked a lot of speculation online. With respect, why speculate about the hand signal when the guy's got stuff written all over his face? I mean, the hand signal will not have been anything other than an equally malevolent reality to what he's wearing on his head. Now, as the judge asked if there were any other matters to discuss before dismissal, a member of Wilson's defence team actually spoke up to advise the judge of his client's final chilling request. He said, "I understand he has other cases pending here and elsewhere, but Mr. Wilson asked me to ask the court within whatever authority you have to get him to death row as soon as possible." That's what his lawyer actually asked for. Now, is it possible at that point that somebody's like, "I've got like a shotgun under here. I mean, the right to bear arms and all that in America. Should we just do it now? Maybe get the jury out. We don't want to traumatise. Yes, Jean, you from canteen, you can go as well. What's that, Gary? Yes, Gary from security. I know that. No, Gary from security, you're not pulling the trigger. I worry about you, Gary. You do weird hand signals as well. Anyway, just clear the court and we'll get this done quickly." Not appropriate, Emma. I know, not appropriate, Emma. But what I'm saying is, it's what he wanted, it's what he's asked for. Now, some people will say, well, doesn't that indicate that he's got an issue with his mental health? Doesn't that indicate that this is an individual who is not aware of the sanctity of his own life and therefore might be somebody dealing with emotional and physiological dysfunction? And is it therefore correct to kill him? And I think that's a fair question to ask. But equally, I think when you're dealing with somebody who's got psychopathic traits, you're dealing with somebody who has ego on the level that this man potentially has, then consequently, he is somebody that wants to control things. And getting prison over with as quickly as possible and not serving out the next 40 years inside may well be something that he wants to get over and done with in that moment. Or he doesn't want to deal with the stress of years on death row to ultimately finally get killed, because that's very stress provoking. So it could actually be a move that just makes it easier for him psychologically to manage the situation at hand, which is arguably going to be an incarceration for a very, very long period of time. He just wants it to be done. Now, during a press conference immediately following his sentencing, State Attorney Amira Fox said this: "I've been doing this 34 years, and I have to say, I have never seen someone as evil as Wade Wilson, and I have never been so stunned to see some people in the community that actually think it's a good idea to support somebody so evil and monstrous." And we'll talk about that in a minute, because believe me, there have been a whole heap of people who've been supporting Wade Wilson. Understandably, when it came down to the families of the victims, they celebrated the verdict. They vowed that the next time Wade Wilson would see them would be at his execution. They said that he had put them through 5 years of agony. And it's true, isn't it? Because they hadn't even got their court date because of all the stops and issues that had occurred. So they'd waited 5 years to even get that guilty verdict and to know that ultimately he will take his last breath in the death chamber. And for them, understandably, that's very satisfying. They want that verdict. They've got that verdict. They're happy with that verdict. And I imagine it's been galling watching this man firstly get support from the outside world, which we'll talk about in a moment, but also seemingly not show any remorse, not take any accountability, not take any responsibility. And you see, if we're going to play into this idea that he was fine until 11 years of age by his own statement, that until 11 he was okay, then it all spiraled, knowing what he's done in the culmination of that spiraling, you would imagine he would be able to take a breath and say, what I did was wrong. But no, absolutely not. That's not who he is. Now, since he has been charged and found guilty, another ex-girlfriend of him, a girl called Kelly Matthews, she's spoken out since the murders. She said that Wilson wasn't actually violent when they got together, but she said that when he started using cocaine, his behavior did change. She ended the relationship after he physically and sexually assaulted her in the back of a car. She said that during that attack, at some point he bit her face, he bit her in the chin, and that attack actually took place just before the double murders. Now, once she got away from Wilson, she did report that assault to the police, but he wasn't arrested because there were no witnesses and there apparently wasn't a lot of evidence. And she said, "I was just more angry that Diane and Christine's murders could have been avoided if they'd just have listened to me and put him in jail at the time," which we completely connect with. But equally, when it comes down to it, you do need evidence to put people like that in prison. So it's a rock and a hard place for the authorities. Now, one of the things that's really worrying to some degree, sorry guys, I'm going to throw it out there. I know we are all in, look, I'm wearing this top because we all know that we feel this connection with true crime. We all want absolute justice for victims. But you know what? Sometimes social media catches fire for the wrong reasons. And I feel in the Wade Wilson case, that's what's happened. Just bear with me. Hear me out on this one. So we totally understand that people are intrigued and curious. And we understand that people are sharing things on court TV, people talking about the case. Of course, it's what I do. But it's gone so far, stroke too far, as to a point where people are romanticising these murders. People are finding him attractive and he's getting to become more popular. So during his 5 years in prison, this double murderer, this abuser of women, this horrendous example of a human, he has, and I kid you not, received thousands of fan mail, love letters, X-rated photos from admirers, people taking pictures of themselves, their intimate parts, and sending them to him. A few even went ahead and wrote to the judge, pleading for mercy and asserting that Wilson's behaviour had changed whilst he was taking medication. Okay then, no problem. You can imagine the judge receiving it, can't you? You're just like, oh, I've got a letter. Nice little letter here. Who's this from? Oh, it's from Mary. Mary from Ohio. Now, who's Mary getting in contact with me about? Oh, Wade Wilson. Wade Wilson's a nasty man. Yeah. I did suggest in court that we could just execute him there and then, but apparently it's not okay. It's apparently a homicide doing that, even though he got the death penalty. I was just thinking it was a tax-saving opportunity, but apparently not. Apparently there'd be a whole issue with my actions, so I didn't go ahead with it. Although I did have to argue security down. They were very into the idea. He'd actually brought his own sawn off with him. Anyway, I digress. So Mary from Ohio. What's Mary saying? Oh, Mary's suggesting that Wade Wilson's actually just misunderstood and he's a really nice guy. And now he's medicated. He's great. Just going to release him, because that makes perfect sense. I mean, if Mary from Ohio is saying that Wade Wilson's a lovely guy and he's fine now, he's medicated. Sorry? No. Mary isn't a doctor or a medic or a psychiatrist or anything to do with it. Sorry? No. Mary has absolutely no contact apart from sending explicit selfies to him. But she knows. So I'm thinking maybe we should just let him out. What do you reckon? Good idea, bad idea? Should we just think about it over a gin and tonic? Anyway, the point is, this is what people are doing. They're begging that the judge save his life because in their head, I don't know, they're romantically involved. And one woman, a mother of two, actually claimed that Wade is a different person now and said, if you look past his tattoos to his face structure since being in prison and medicated, he is healthier. His face is fuller compared to his booking in picture where his face is gaunt, pale, and he looks unhealthy. Oh, well, again, it's another reason. I mean, just going to throw it out there. He got done for narcotics in prison in 2023. So just because he's eating well, doesn't mean he ain't dealing with the drugs still. Now, whilst in prison, he's received nearly 4,000 messages. Let it sink in that 163 of those were inappropriate pictures. That's right, ladies and gents. Pictures of areas of our body that should never be sent to a prisoner. Just throwing it out there. Number one, the people read the letters, so whatever you're sending, people are going to be seeing your foof and your bits, aren't they? Because they're opening them to check you're not sending anything inappropriate, but you obviously didn't get the message, and now, I don't know, all of those prison officers are having a right giggle at your undergarments. But that's what people are doing. Now, we do know hebristophilia is a paraphilia involving sexual interest and attraction to those who commit crimes. It's actually derived from the Greek word hebrizin, which means to commit an outrage against somebody. And essentially, it means that you feel very attracted to people who do horrendous things. So lots of high-profile criminals have received this kind of fan mail. A lot of them are amorous or sexually motivated because of this particular paraphilia. It's a phenomena that is hard to understand, but it's certainly something that we see in high-profile cases like that. Other people call it Bonnie and Clyde syndrome. But what it really means is that somebody has heard about a case, fixated on a case, gone, oh, he doesn't look like a murderer, but I kind of fancy him. So I'm going to deny everything that not right has done. And I'm going to just get in contact and then I'm going to believe that I can change him. This is also why a lot of women end up in terrible relationships, guys. I'm throwing it out there. Don't try fixing people. Don't try fixing them. Just acknowledge that there is a brokenness and that you don't need to go near that brokenness. Now, don't get me wrong. There is also a deviance within certain women, rarer, where they are really turned on by sadism. But again, either direction, it's not okay. Either direction, seek therapy. Like I say, this guy has swamped the internet. Pictures of him everywhere, pictures about him everywhere. I would love to know your thoughts. The point is, will he get his quick death? Or will indeed this be a long protracted reality of the system that we see time and time again? I'll add in the description below when I know the answer to that. In the meantime, my lovelies, you take care. I hope you found it interesting. What are your thoughts on these women who can't help but send inappropriate pictures of themselves to somebody who literally executed two incredible women in cold blood with no reason? Could you imagine ever finding that anything but utterly distasteful, deviant, disgusting, and of course, murderous? That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.